is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
The Earth Transformed, a new book, an extensive tour through Homo sapiens and before, mankind and the ecology of the Earth. We are in the 21st century, so this is a commonplace topic now, climate change. However, I welcome Professor Peter Frankopan, Professor of Global History at Worcester College, Oxford, whose new book is The Earth Transformed, an Untold History. We'll begin in the Holocene with two violent events to show that mankind responds to nature, responds to catastrophe, responds to climate change, and gets lucky sometimes. Professor, a very good evening to you. Congratulations. We begin with the breakdown of the ice dam in the Laurentide part of North America, which changed the ocean circulation and affected climate globally. And then also within the same time frame, 7th, 8th century, 7th millennium before the Common Era, the collapse of a piece of the Norwegian coast that created a tsunami. Those two events, what do they describe? How do they change the nature of mankind at that point, responding to nature? Good evening to you.
Good evening. It's a real pleasure. Thank you so much for having me come and join you, John. And thank you all for listening and watching. Well, I guess the starting point is that we've got so used in the modern era to being masters of our own destiny that we forget about these great forces in the human past and how important they are in our history. And that includes things like volcanic eruptions, of course, going back a long time before humans, asteroid impacts or meteor impacts that got rid of the dinosaurs, amongst other things. But sometimes single one-off events can come from dislocations of global climate patterns that can produce cascade effects. It's a phrase that is much spoken about today by scientists warning about, for example, points of no return, where you enter a violent circle, a vicious circle, where heating generates more warm waters that melt ice even quicker. And these two events that you mentioned, one is the Laurentide ice sheet that is a dam that holds together part of an ice dam over the Hudson Bay, and that suddenly produced very, very heavy levels of flooding and accelerates a whole series of circulation patterns that makes the Northern Hemisphere become about 1 to 3 degrees warmer and sea level rises of about a meter. This is taking place at the time of the transition out of the Ice Age, where the movement of the sea levels globally is such that about a third of the continent of what's now Australia was underwater. And through new scientific techniques using LIDAR and thermal imaging, we can see human habitations that are 160 miles off the coast of what's now Australia as a result. So these big events have shaped the ecologies, they've shaped the landscapes, and they've opened up opportunities for some of our ancestors, but they've closed them off for others. So in the case of the Laurentide Ice Sheet, for example, the dramatic changes to the geology of Northern America and the Northern Hemisphere produced a burst of a signal and a pulse of humans settling in North America, making it easier. In the case of the landslide off Norway, well, what that did had in some ways dramatic effects that are visible today, which is it cut off what's now Great Britain from the rest of Europe, where they were connected by land. The flooding was so extensive that it went many kilometers inland. And the long-term effect that had on the politics, let's say, of Europe was that by the time of the 17th and 18th century, a time of European competition, the British didn't have to keep such a large land army as its European rivals, because to protect the borders of France or Austria, you needed several hundred thousand men. And the British invested their money in small numbers of elite troops, and above all in a navy to protect and patrol their coast. And that then led to, I think you could argue, the rise of the idea that Britain was exceptional. It was different in some ways to its European neighbours, but also similar when it wanted to be. And even things like Brexit maybe wouldn't have happened if we'd all been part of the same landmass and had similar kinds of experiences. But geology, geography, and these events, climatological and otherwise, have a great deal, I think, to make us think differently about the past.
I seize on these two events because they're, well, dramatic. But at the same time, they're happening inside the Holocene period, where you emphasize it's possible that photosynthesis has become more effective, that there are more calories available, especially for farmers. And this is a transformation from the so-called hunter-gatherer to farming community. But you've taught me that it's not so neat. That was always too much clear this side or that side. It has been going on for some years, and farming has been spreading from, I guess, the Middle East, Mesopotamia, all the way to Europe. At the event of this collapse of the Norwegian coast and the flooding of what is now the English Channel, was there farming going on in what is now France and Britain? Were they already agricultural?
A lot depends on what these terms mean, and in the absence of written evidence, who chooses to apply them. So we think of farming as something that is, you know, a homestead where there's a small family, perhaps, that is deliberately cultivating a set number of fields for their own benefits and perhaps surplus that they can do something with. But in other ways, the domestication of crops and even the domestication of animals, it's quite a gray area. I mean, in fact, even today, those distinctions about what is a hunter-gatherer, who is sedentary, who is nomadic, I think are very blurred. And I think it just speaks to our idea that we want to see kind of breakthrough moments. We want to be able to date when farming began and then assume that once it had begun, knowledge was passed on, like in a classroom, from one community to the other, and people just got better and better at stuff, because that's what the modern era makes us think. But the haphazard experimentation, the failures, the ways in which crops didn't feed you, the ways in which people ate things that killed them, those things don't survive. So I think the interesting thing, I think, for me is why do we want to make a distinction about when the first towns or cities or urban settlements begin, and how do we try to explain those? But clearly, like you say, John, the key is calorie availability, because if you're able to feed yourself with less labor input, then your output could be spent on other things. And if you can find a good niche that allows you plentiful ability to cultivate or to be able to harvest what grows naturally, then your ability to create hierarchies and to have people who are stronger or better access to water or better access to or better soils then starts to create the kinds of competition for space and therefore social competitions that lead to all sorts of different kinds of social patterns. And often the discussion has been with archaeologists and anthropologists has been around cities doing something different, but you find hierarchies in different ways in mobile groups and in indigenous peoples. So there are just different ways in which things get solved, but it's how you can exploit the environment and the natural resources to one's own benefit is the key.
One of the joys of your book, Professor, is that you do not just keep us into Northern Europe where we've read all the stories and enjoyed all the plays. You travel to the American bottom, that's the Mississippi, you travel to China, especially Northern China, travel to the Nile Valley, you travel to Niger, where they had ostrich egg shells for carrying water, for ceramics at this time. The cultures are all responding to global changes in climate. And Northern Europe responded to that tsunami. But ENSO, the North Atlantic circulation, does that mirror other things that are going on in the Pacific at the time? Do we have a record of that?
Well, so the first, I mean, it's a great question. So, I mean, I think I'm the part of the first generation of historians where we are living through the greatest breakthrough in how we look at history since the invention of writing scripts. So the ways in which we can use the sciences and scientific data to reshape and re-understand the past, it is so profound because of the new kinds of data sources we have available. The challenge looking at big patterns is that our data is incomplete. So we tend to have quite good materials, for example, about North America, because there are well-funded universities and institutions that fund research projects. So we've got a pretty good idea about levels of precipitation, temperatures, et cetera, not just in the modern period, and not even in antiquity, but going deep into the past. But the continents and the places that you mentioned that I write about, such as West Africa or Polynesia or the Americas before Columbus, have much, much more patchy and sketchy records. So oftentimes you're looking at a jigsaw that has coherent parts of it that will tell you what's going on, but then there's fuzziness around the edge. And it's difficult sometimes to be absolutely precise about these things, but there are a whole system of global weather patterns that are closely connected. The North Atlantic Oscillation, the El Niño-La Niña cycle, which is the dominant climate signal on Earth, the behavior of the sun, the eccentricity of the Earth's orbit, the way in which the moon still affects things like tides and tidal patterns in the Earth today. And it stands to reason that over thousands of years or hundreds of thousands of years, those patterns will change. So we have a pretty good idea about what's happening where, but it's very rarely things all happening at the same way at the same time. So in the modern era right now, when we're talking the 21st century, for the first time we've ever got any records, the whole planet is all warming at the same time. And that has never happened before. That we've got no moment where we can tell that Europe and the Northern Hemisphere is warming, and so is the Southern Hemisphere, and whichever longitude you go on to. But in the past, you'll have to be highly selective based on what data you have available. But that availability is totally transformational, eye-opening, and almost blinding, because most historians, we learn how to read texts, we learn about the archaeology and the art and the material culture. But now historians need to understand genomics, plant sciences, biology, chemistry, geochemistry, to be able to use these data sources. And if you don't, you're turning your back on materials that allow you to think about the past in a different way.
Peter Frankopan, Professor of Global History, Worcester College, Oxford. The book is The Earth Transformed. We're headed to cities and trade and what looks like globalization, a.k.a. connectivity. I'm John Batchelor.